I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today it's Midday on Money. Monday is tax day, but we should do our best to be financially literate and financially empowered every day. What does it mean to be financially empowered? How should we prioritize our spending if we're juggling credit card debt and student loans? What are the hallmarks of a good savings plan? And once we've saved a little, where should we invest it? How can we best meet the challenges of saving for a house, paying tuition, or retirement? Nicholas Abrams of AJW Financial and Stuart Ritter of T. Rowe Price join me to help make sense of the often confusing and mystifying tenets of managing our finances. Midday on Money starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us. Today, it's Midday on Money. This season's tax filing deadline is fast approaching. It's this coming Monday at midnight if you haven't filed your taxes yet. And this year, Americans are encountering what amounts to the biggest changes to the U.S. tax code in more than three decades. Whether we wind up paying more taxes this year or less, planning for the future and increasing our financial literacy are always smart moves. Regardless of how much money we have, how well we manage it, will have a huge impact on how financially empowered we feel. Today, two experts join me in Studio A to help us up our games a bit when it comes to managing our money. Nicholas Abrams is a certified financial planner and the founder and CEO of AJW Financial Partners, LLC, here in Baltimore. He hosts a television show called Financial Empowerment with Nick Abrams, which has been running on cable outlets in a number of states since 2015, and he's the former host of a personal finance show on WOLB Radio. Nick Abrams, welcome. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Tom.
Stuart Ritter is a CFP in the Individual Investors segment of T. Rowe Price, based here in Baltimore. He's taught personal finance at Johns Hopkins University, and he serves on the Maryland Council on Economic Education. Stuart Ritter, welcome.
Good Thank you.
So listeners, if you've got some questions about finance for Nick and Stuart, give us a call, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. You can drop us a tweet at midday WIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. We are streaming live from Studio A. So Nick Abrams, let's start by asking what you mean. I want to unpack these two terms, financial literacy and financial empowerment.
Okay.
Let's start with empowerment. What does that mean in your view?
In my view, it really means giving people, the individual investor, the opportunity to take control of their finances, their wealth, their well-being, giving them the opportunity to plan for their future and also plan for generational wealth. So not just for their future, but the future of their kids, grandkids, and transferring of wealth.
And the empowerment part of it comes with, it indicates a level of confidence, which a lot of people don't have.
Right.
Finances are just intimidating.
Well, yeah, it is. You know, I talk to a lot of people, whether they're doctors, attorneys, whether they're maintenance workers, and you talk about money and everybody tenses up because it's a very sensitive and personal subject. But really what we try to do is tell people, look, money is always going to be there. It's an important factor. It's why we go to work. We go to work to provide for our families. So let's take the tenseness off of it and let's make it more personal and let's look at how to empower you to take control of your money.
Because I guess for anybody who understands money like you, anybody who works with money, who advises a variety of clients, it's not as mystifying. I mean, is it kind of like driving a stick shift? Once you learn how to do it, you know, you
can
do it?
Well, like I say, Tom, everybody has a gift. So when I speak to people, I always tell people, look, I could change the oil in my car, but most likely I'm not going to do it. And the same thing with finances. You know, it's my gift in finance. So yes, for me, it does seem very easy, carefree. It's second nature. But that's not for everybody. So even if it's not for you, you can still have the tools to empower yourself to get financially in order.
And then Stuart Ritter, financial literacy, that's also very important. And we hear a lot about how Americans in general are not nearly financially literate enough. So what does that mean?
Financial literacy often refers to understanding the fundamentals of how to manage your money. So everything from how a savings account and a credit card works to understanding how to invest and getting the right mix between stocks, bonds, and cash for your goals, time horizon, what account to use for retirement. So to get to that point where you feel empowered, where you feel like I am confident making the decisions I need to make about money for what I want to do with it, often requires kind of a base level of understanding how it works. You don't have to have a lot of details, but the literacy part implies that you've got the basic understanding to allow you to make those decisions on your road to empowerment.
A couple of studies, one is about 4 years old, found that 30% of Americans were able to answer three simple financial questions. They concerned inflation, interest compounding, and risk diversification. So 70% of us as a country, weren't able to sort of understand, get our arms wrapped around those basic terms. There also seems to me that there's so many different tools out there. There's so many different things you can do with your money and ways you can handle your money. I mean, it used to be you had a checking account and a savings account, and that ain't the case anymore, is it?
There's
a million different, I mean, even when you want to give money to a friend, you used to, you know, give them cash or write them a check. Now it's Venmo and, you know, every bank has a way of transferring money from yourself to somebody's cat if you want to. It's crazy.
The industry got more complicated. One of the things that's happening now, though, is recognizing that not everybody wants that complexity. So I'll go back to your stick shift analogy. Not everybody wants to drive a stick shift car. It takes a lot more effort and paying attention to things. So what you're seeing happening is a lot of things coming in place to make this simpler, to make it easier, like automatic transmissions. So an easy example is if you're investing for retirement. It used to be you had to pick all the mutual funds and put the portfolio together yourself. A recent innovation is something called a retirement date fund, which is a fund that gives you the diversification you need, gives you the right mix of stocks, bonds, and short-term investments, changes over time so that you only have to make that one decision, and then you have the opportunity to let the automatic transmission take over. So there is certainly more complexity. At the same time, people should recognize that there are tools out there that will help make things easier for them. And if they take advantage of those, they don't have to get into an overwhelming level of detail.
Yeah. And Nick Abrams, I mean, it's also a lot about the confidence and the self-awareness to know what your priorities are. If you're living paycheck to paycheck, because there are a lot of folks listening to say, you know, look, I don't have any money to save. I'm barely making the rent and making my car payment, et cetera. It's a matter of a discipline of savings.
You know, Tom, you said the right word, priorities. So we all have priorities in life. And one of the things that I always tell people have that problem of, okay, how do I start off? You have to make it a priority. And I give the example, you know, there's a store called Wegmans that has these great chocolate chip cookies with walnuts that
I used to love them.
And I've been saying my waist is getting bigger and bigger, but yet I kept going and getting the cookies. Well, I keep saying I want to lose weight, but it wasn't a priority because I kept getting the cookies. But once I finally realized, okay, I want to lose some weight, it's now a priority. It's a goal. It's something I've written down that I want to do. Then I stopped getting the cookies. So when you're looking at finances, it has to be a priority. And I tell people, when you're creating your budget or when you're looking at goals, be realistic. If you know that you have to have that Starbucks coffee every day to survive, then you put it in there, but you take something else out that you don't need. And a lot of people, they get their spreadsheets and they start calculating their budgets and they've got the apps and they put this nice perfect budget together, but they don't stick to it because it's not realistic. So your budget has to be realistic and it has to take into account what are your priorities and you have to write them down. If your priority is getting out of debt, then fine, you make those sacrifices when you have it prioritized. And that's the key.
I mean, is it even possible for someone, let's say a young person, you know, in their 20s, out of college, you know, recently facing enormous student debt. I mean, nationally, we're at $1.4 trillion in student debt the last time I checked.
And growing.
I mean, it's a lot of people point to that particular thing is the next big crisis that we have, akin to the crisis that we survived, 10 years ago. If you're paying down student debt, if you're paying rent, if you're paying a car payment, there are still ways of siphoning off a little bit to put for your retirement or towards a house.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. I mean, starting something in your company plan, most employers will match up to a certain amount. So you should at least always put in up to that match if it's 3% or 4%. Because if you don't, you're leaving free money on the table. And then you go through and prioritize. So if paying off that student loan is a priority, then you might cut out some of the eating out, some of the happy hours, some of your travel until you get that particular debt paid off, and then you work on the next goal. But you can't have it all. You know, a lot of people, they graduate from college, were happy, excited. Yes, I'm independent. I want the house, the car, the travel, because I'm young and I want to enjoy myself. Well, you got to prioritize those things, especially if you have a large amount of student loan debt.
Yeah, and it is interesting, Stuart Ritter, that the actual, the sort of millennial approach to home ownership in particular is very different than it was a generation or two ago. Fewer and fewer millennials are all that interested in buying a house. They're happy to rent. When it comes to those kinds of decisions, rent versus buy, or, lease versus purchase a car, or buy a new car or a used car, or financing your student loans, those kinds of things. Where do you start figuring out how to approach, how to even, sort of calculate those decisions?
Yeah, it starts with the priorities Nick was talking about. And then if you've decided, well, I need a place to live, I need a car, having that budget allows you to see what not just the current cash flow impact is if I rent versus buy, but then what's the long-term impact? And a lot of it is, what are your long-term goals? Have you sat down and said, okay, I'm going to commit to being in this geographic location for the next 10 years, because that's kind of a prerequisite before you're going to buy. If you're planning to move in 3 years, buying a house is not a good idea. So it starts with understanding what your priorities are, what your goals are, which I recognize if you're straight out of college, or even if college was a couple of years ago, it's kind of hard to pin that stuff down. So one of the things to keep in mind is, how much flexibility will this decision give me or take away? If I sign on a dotted line and I'm now committing to a certain amount every month to finance something, not only am I spending my money today, but I'm committing my own future self, that when I earn income in the future, I can't buy something I want to buy then. I have to pay for what I've thought about I want right now. So thinking about how this affects you today, what flexibility it might or might not give you, and what impact it's going to have on your own future self can help people decide, should I be renting? Should I be buying? Should I be financing? Are there other ways to solve my transportation costs? Because you brought up the number one and two expenses that everybody has, housing and transportation. Mm-hmm. So the decisions you make in those two categories affect every other aspect of your life. Your clothes, how often you go out, what you're eating, the vacations, saving for retirement, kids' education, all of those things. So pay attention to the decisions you're making in housing and transportation. They have a big effect.
Speaking of transportation, we have an email from Oren. He says, I'm 29 years old. I'm single. I'm making around $50,000 a year from a 9-to-5 day job and several night gigs. I've never really had any financial education in my family or schooling, and I want to buy a new or used car, a new/used car, in the near future, but don't really know where to start with financing a loan. Any advice for what someone in my position should be doing to set themselves up for the future to avoid this constant cycle of draining most of my paycheck every month with nothing to show for it? When it comes to financing something like, as Stuart says, this important thing, transportation and housing.
So one of the things I would recommend is, first of all, check with your credit union if you belong to a credit union, or whoever you have some type of banking relationship with, to see, first of all, what kind of rates they are offering on the car. I always advise clients that if you're going in to purchase a car, you want to have your financing already prepared before you walk in the door. That's one of the ways that you know.
So don't do the financing at the dealership.
No, do it beforehand if you can, because that way you know upfront what your interest rate is, and then that can help determine what your price or your payments are going to be for the car. And so that would be the first step. But also, even before then, you want to check your credit just to make sure everything is A-okay with your credit, that there are no mistakes, that there's nothing that's on there that should not be on there, which is easy to do. One of the three crediting bureaus, you can reach out to them and get your credit report right online, and you can get that for free. So those are the top two things I would look at doing. And the third thing would be to set a budget. You want to make sure that you know what price range you want to be in before you go to the dealership. Because walking into a car dealership is like walking into a candy store. There's the base model and there's the top of the line model. And of course, they're going to push you towards the top of the line model. And it's going to have all the bells and whistles, and you're going to feel good until you get that first monthly payment and ask yourself, oh no, what did I do?
Yeah, there's that car with the box of the Wegmans chocolate chip cookies sitting on the front seat. I cannot resist this. Exactly. Nicholas Abrams is a certified financial planner and the founder and CEO of AJW Financial Partners. Stuart Ritter is also a financial planner with T. Rowe Price. Midday on Money continues after a short break. When we come back, we'll welcome your questions and comments about personal finance. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle at Midday WIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's number one news talk station.
Thanks, Matt, and welcome back, everybody. By the way, a quick word about tomorrow's show. My guest will be the New York Times writer-at-large Nathaniel Rich. He's the author of Losing Earth, A Recent History. It's about the global response to climate change. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Pantheon. That's the new play at Happenstance Theater at the Theater Project. So hope you'll join us tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday on Money. My guests are two certified financial planners, Stuart Ritter of T. Rowe Price and Nicholas Abrams of AJW Financial Partners. Our phone number at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.com. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WYPR. And you can ping us on Facebook, where we are streaming our conversation here from Studio A. So, gentlemen, we have an email from a 30-year-old in Baltimore who's not giving us his or her name. I'm living with my fiance. We are lucky to have little debt outside a house payment, which is well within our budget, and one car payment. I've been fortunate to have had a job making more than I would imagine for a few years in my 20s when I was able to put away tens of thousands of dollars on top of retirement Roth IRA. But it's just sitting in my checking account. What should I do with about $50,000 just sitting in a checking account right now that's above what is required for our needs, and we have enough for a lot of our wants? So who wants to start with that one? Stuart, what do you think?
First of all, congratulations on having a, quote, problem like that. That's great. That takes a lot of discipline, as Nick was talking about, some forethought. Clearly living below your means, making good decisions, not only for what you want in the present, but for the future. So let's talk about that future. So that $50,000, there are a couple of things you can be thinking about. Number one, you mentioned taking care of what your needs are and your wants. The first one would be, do you have an emergency fund in place? If something were to happen and you or your fiance were to lose their job, for example, do you have 3 to 6 months of your expenses put away, set aside, so you could cover whatever it is you have to pay for while it takes you to find a new job? Second, do you have the right insurance in place? So health, all the other kinds of things, especially if you're getting engaged, if you're now relying on each other's income for some of your goals, life insurance becomes more important. And that kind of forms the safety net underneath you. You said you were on track for retirement. That sounds great. So let's start thinking about what else you and your fiance might want to be buying in the future. Is a house in the future at some point? A vacation?
It sounds like they have a house. So they're saying we have a house payment.
That's right.
And it's within our budget, and they have one car payment.
That's
so they're
right.
Good to go on that. Yeah.
So if you've got that stuff in place, then you can start thinking about what else you might want in the future. So is it a larger house at some point? If it's not, then start thinking about when you might or might not spend the money. Because money sitting in a checking account is usually for something you're going to be buying within 2 years. So if you don't think you'll be using this money for 2 years, that's your opportunity to start thinking thinking about other investments that might give you a bigger opportunity to grow with more short-term risk, but a potentially higher return for something you might want to buy 5, 10, 20 years down the road. So those kinds of things, as you sit down and say, here are our priorities, here are our goals, start decking the money against those things. Safety nets like emergency fund and insurance, and then thinking about what else you might want to spend.
And of course, Nick Abrams, when it comes to investing in the stock market, I mean, that's like going to Vegas in a certain way, right?
It doesn't have to be, Tom. And there is some risk involved. It's an investment. So any type of investment that you go into, there's some type of risk. But the key is, how do you manage that risk? And so if you are somebody who is in their 20s or 30s and your goal is saving for retirement, that's money that you're not going to need for another 30 plus years. So you want to put it in a portfolio. It's going to go up and down, but long term, history has shown us you're going to make money in the markets over a long period of time. And as Stuart said, if your goal is much shorter, if you're looking for 2 years or less, then you don't want to have your money necessarily in the market. But also, it's looking at what you're investing in. I always tell people, you know, you have to be careful of what you hear at dinner or cocktail parties, because people always spurt out the good things.
Yeah, I got a big tip to get such and such a
stock.
They'll
tell you that tip. They won't tell you the other money they lost on all the other tips that they handed out. So you always want to be careful with that and talk to a professional. You know, there are a lot of professionals out there, if you're not sure, that you can sit down and have a conversation with to say, this is what I have, these are my goals, this is what I'm thinking about. Should I really invest in this tip that I heard, or is there another program out there that I can look at?
And tell me about that relationship between you as a certified financial planner and your individual investor client. I mean, what services do you provide? What does it cost to have a personal financial planner as opposed to going online and, you know, using the tools that are available online to give you suggestions about how to divide your portfolio and that kind of thing?
So if you're looking at establishing a financial planning relationship with a client, which is different than just a transactional relationship, a financial planner has a fiduciary responsibility to put the client's interest ahead of theirs. So there was a whole Department of Labor fiduciary standard that went out a few years ago. So that's what a financial planner is. They sit there and they're looking at your whole entire picture. Some planners charge hourly. Some planners will charge a straight fee, flat fee for the service. So it depends. I have some colleagues that charge anywhere between $125 an hour to $300 per hour for their services. And some advisors have a flat fee of $2,500, and I've heard that fee all the way up to $25,000. Depending upon
on how much you're investing,
right,
in that kind
and
of
the level of complexity to your situation. Mm-hmm. But the advisor is there to look at your whole entire picture, not just to pitch a product, but to sit down and really plan your goals and look at a strategy for you.
Let's go to Judith on the phone in Baltimore. Judith, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine. What's on your mind?
Okay, I have been left a trust fund that is less than $1 million. It's between $600,000 and $650,000, depending, you know. My daughters are the trustees. However, we have gone from one big bank to another big bank, and they're terrible, and we can't find anybody other than these huge commercial banks who are not giving us access to our money, or who make it very difficult, and we don't know what to do.
When you say you're not getting access to your money, is it restricted by the covenants of the particular trust?
It's the bank's decision. There's always a problem. We had to go from one huge bank that were the trustees. It took us over a year to get away from them and get my daughters to be trustees. We moved the fund to another big bank, and now we, the trustees who are my daughters, cannot get access to the funds to pay bills, like for the lawyer and for the CPA who just prepared our taxes.
So, Stuart, it sounds like Judith, you know, has got to make sure that she has a good understanding about what that relationship is with whatever institution she's dealing with.
Absolutely. For those of you who are not familiar with what Judith is describing, most of us own our possessions, our money directly. What Judith is describing is someone has left money in a separate legal entity called a trust that has, as you referred to, Tom, some requirements about when that money can be used and for what. And very often, sometimes other financial institutions will be involved in making some of those decisions. So it sounds like more of a legal issue than a financial planning issue. So it's not what do we do with this money? How do we make plans with this money? It sounds like we're having difficulty either having the trust be operated according to its provisions or something else. And that's more of a legal issue than it is necessarily a financial planning issue.
Let's go back to the phones to Powell in Baltimore. Powell, welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure. My
question is about how do we know when we need a financial planner? My wife and I have been going back and forth about whether to seek one. And I think we have this tendency to say, like, oh, maybe we can figure it out ourselves. But what are some honest questions that your guests think that we should ask ourselves that would tell us that maybe we need some expertise here?
That's a good question. So Powell's question, Nick Abrams, right, is, you know, what kinds of questions should you ask if you're thinking about engaging a planner?
So it goes back to what are you looking to plan for? That's one of the big things. And then once you sort of figure out what it is you're looking to plan for or what you need help with, then the key is to find the right advisor to fit that need. Because, you know, advisors, we are all different. Some of us have specialties, special areas that we work with for our clients. So not every advisor fits that particular client. One of the things I tell people when you're looking for an advisor, you want to try to get a referral from somebody who's in a situation somewhat or similar to yours. That kind of makes it easier. If you have that referral and your brother-in-law or your cousin or your friend, if they trust that advisor and they're doing well, then you might want to look at meeting with that advisor. Then you want to find out the advisor's qualifications. You know, are they certified? How are they compensated? Are they captive, which means that they can only sell the product of one specific company, or do they have autonomy of what type of products and services that they offer? And how often do they meet with their clients, and what type of relationship do they have? And lastly, I'll say, Tom, you know, working with an advisor is like another family member. Advisors are there for the good times. They're there for the weddings, retirement, celebrations. Unfortunately, advisors are there for the not-so-good times, so for the deaths, funerals, illnesses. So you want to make sure whoever you're picking is going to be there for you when you need them, but also when your spouse, partner, or children needs them as well.
And they're there for the market corrections,
yes,
as you guys call them, you know, corrections.
The good times in the markets and the times that are a little bit questionable. Yeah, you want to make sure that advisor is there walking you through and to answer questions for you.
Yeah, everybody else calls it the red ink plague. Let's go back to the phones to Todd in Baltimore. Todd, welcome to Midday with Stuart Ritter and Nick Abrams.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I'm in the process of possibly investing in some exchange-traded funds or ETFs, and I want to know what are the pros and cons for investing in that in short-term and long-term?
All right, thanks for that question. Stuart, an ETF mutual fund, what is that?
That's got to stand for something, right?
Yeah, it does. Sounds impressive.
It does. Exchange-traded fund. But here's how we got there. When the stock market was first created, there were only three stocks to choose from. So it was pretty easy for an individual person to decide which stock to buy and how much and execute that transaction. And at some point, about when there were 900 stocks, somebody said, let's make this easier for folks. Let's package a bunch of stocks together. Let's have a professional figure out which stocks should go in the package, and then people can just buy the package. Instead of buying it individually, everybody would fund the purchases together. They'd fund it mutually, so let's call that a mutual fund. And that was the beginning of the mutual fund. So that's where you could get a package of stocks. And then later on, someone said, you know, instead of going to a specific company and buying the mutual fund, why don't we take these packages of stocks and let people trade those packages of stocks on the stock exchange. So we'll call that an exchange-traded fund. So, Todd, what you're talking about is...
It's kind of double packaging, isn't it?
Well, there are different kinds of packages. There's the mutual fund package and the exchange-traded fund package. And which one makes sense for you depends on whether you're buying it within a retirement plan, whether you're buying it a one lump sum purchase or over the lots of purchases over the long term. So before you get to which package should I be using, you have to step back and think about, well, what's in the package? Do I have the right package? As Nick was talking about earlier, if you're saving for retirement, you want something that has a lot of stocks. And if you're not the kind of person who wants to be involved all the time, like driving your stick shift car, you want to get something that's going to change by itself over time, moves from stocks to bonds. So get those decisions in place. And then once you've figured out what that needs to be, then you're at the point where you can say, okay, does it make sense for me to buy a mutual fund that gives me this package, or does it make sense to buy an exchange-traded fund that gives me this package?
Yeah, and that's what you're talking about, these retirement date funds. You know, if you know you're going to retire in 2052, you can buy a fund where managers from Vanguard or Fidelity or T. Rowe Price are going to say, okay, right now you should be investing in ABC, and then when you're closer to 2052, you should be investing in XYZ. Yeah. So, Nick Abrams, let me ask you a question that may cause you to, you know, jump up and flash a crucifix and garlic because I'm a vampire. But there's a guy named Jack Bogle who was with Vanguard,
yes,
who right around the time he retired as a very wealthy man, mm-hmm, said that he came to be of the opinion that people shouldn't manage their money. Mm-hmm. What they should do is just put it in what's called an index fund.
Yes.
So the Standard & Poor's 500 index, you buy a chunk of all 500 of those stocks. And
correct,
then when the stock market goes up, you get wealthier. When it goes down, everybody else is getting as less wealthy as you. I mean, the stock market, when Barack Obama was elected in 2009, it was at 6,000,
yes,
right?
This
morning, it's at 26,000. So if
correct,
you'd had your money in the stock market in this index fund for the last 10 years, you'd be doing better than you were. So
yes,
what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, when we look at that, that definitely is the investment model. And you're looking at the market over time, it has gone up tremendously. We've had this 9-10 year run in the market. Here's the thing, though. The world has changed so much over that period of time. Investing was a lot easier 20, 30, 40 years from now. We're in this global economy where, okay, great, you have money in the index fund, but there are a lot of other opportunities and investment strategies that are available. Whether there's in an international market, alternative investments. So the world has evolved over that period of time, and so has investing. So having all of your money just in the index might not be the most appropriate thing for a client. Having some more diversification in international, emerging markets, alternative investments could also be something to help moderate some of the risk. So when the U.S. market goes down, because remember, we were at 14,000 and went down to 6 and then have come back up. So that time where you're going down from 14,000 to 6, you need something to balance that risk out, because investors are human and a lot of people jumped out of the market during that time frame and have been very slow to get back in. So where it sounds great, we went from 6, we're at 26. A lot of people haven't seen that growth because they were out of the market doing a lot of that. And then once it started peaking, they jumped back into the market and missed most of the gains.
Yeah, buy high and sell low. There's a lot of folks who tend to do that. All right, we're going to take a quick break, then we'll come back and take more of your calls and questions. Nicholas Abrams is a certified financial planner and the founder and CEO of AJW Financial Partners. Stuart Ritter is a certified financial planner with the Baltimore-based investment firm T. Rowe Price. By the way, today at this very hour as we speak, high school students from across the state are competing in the Maryland Council on Economic Education's Personal Finance Challenge Bowl. It's just like the NCAA finals, except it has to do with finance. So they're demonstrating their knowledge about topics like spending, credit, savings, investing, income, and proper money management. There are 21 teams from schools all over Maryland, and we wish them luck. We will be back after a short break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR, and you can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
This is your public radio, member-supported 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's number one news talk station.
And welcome back. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Money. We're talking about financial literacy and financial empowerment. Nicholas Abrams is a certified financial planner and the founder and CEO of AJW Financial Partners. Stuart Ritter is also a certified financial planner with T. Rowe Price here in Baltimore. If you've got questions about personal finance that you'd like to pose to our guests, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And our Facebook live stream is available on the WIPR Facebook page. And if you can't get in touch with us any of those ways, you just aren't trying hard enough. Let's go to the emails. We have Mike, who's a senior citizen. So we've talked to a couple of folks in their 20s and 30s. Now we have Mike, who says, when are annuities a good choice for a retired person versus leaving the investment in a diversified IRA, assume age of 75. So annuities as opposed to diversified IRAs. Nick, you want to take that one?
So there are, when you say annuities, there are several types of annuities. And annuities is one of those things that have evolved over the years like everything else, like a car has. There are what we call immediate annuities. So you put in a lump sum of money and you, from that, you receive an income stream that you cannot outlive. It's designed to last as long as you do. So if you live to 100, you'll get a check to age 100 no matter what. So that's one of the things about annuities. There are also some annuities that provide
it's protection. Predictable income.
Predictable income. Mm-hmm. So it's like yesterday's defined benefit or pension plan, which we don't see much anymore. You get that guaranteed income. Then there are annuities that provide protection of principal. So if you are scared of the stock market, you can put your money into their fixed annuities, their fixed index annuities that will guarantee you will not lose your principal and you can earn interest. So that's something you can look at as well. And there are also something that's called a variable annuity, which it's a product issued by an insurance company, but it fluctuates with the stock market. But you can add riders to that that will also guarantee income as well. So your annuity is designed to have some type of protection on your portfolio, whether it's providing you the protection of an income you cannot not outlive or providing protection of the lump sum that's in your portfolio.
Speaking of retirement, Stuart Ritter, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare sent me a press release the other day that claims that the average retirement age in Maryland is 64, and that's 2 years before workers can collect Social Security benefits. This is a question that a lot of seniors are asking. Of course, our director and engineer, Luke, when he read that, he said, oh, gee, Tom, you're 64. Why don't you retire, please, right now? That's a different conversation. Different conversation completely. However, but when to take Social Security? Because you can start it at 66, but if you wait a little longer, the payoff is bigger. How do you make that calculation?
Yeah, we get a lot of questions about people saying, when do I start Social Security? So there are a couple of key ages. Let me clarify a couple of them. The first age for most people at which you can start your Social Security benefit is actually 62. There's something called a full retirement age, which is now 66. And then the benefit that you might get increases up until age 70. So if you haven't started your Social Security benefits by age 70, do it then, because if you wait after that, it doesn't go up. So here's what people need to think about. I can get it at 62, but every year I wait, the amount that I will get, the amount on that check, will go up by about 8%, in addition to whatever cost of living increase goes on. So that's the amount that I will get for the rest of my life, and depending on my circumstances, it can affect the amount that my spouse gets after I pass away. Now, the thing most people are worried about is running out of money at the end of their life, living so long they run out of money. If you wait the longest, if you wait to age 70 to start your Social Security check, that means you get the biggest possible check if you are the person who's lived a long time and you're worried about what kind of money you will have then. 62 gives you the lowest check that you would be having later on. So if your concern is, outliving your money, that bigger check is the one that can protect best against that particular concern. Now, there are a lot of other factors that go into when do I take Social Security? Am I working? Do I have other assets to rely on? So people need to bake those in. But the key thing to remember is I get the lowest amount at 62, or the other way to think about it is I get the highest amount at age 70. And every month before age 70, I start my check, I have permanently reduced the amount that I'm going to get for the rest of my life and potentially for the life of my spouse if they survive me.
Yeah, and interestingly, the trend seems to be that a lot of seniors are choosing to work longer. They're not retiring at 65, which used to be the sort of magic age. You know, they're working until they're 70. They're working until even later, depending on the kind of, job they have. And that, of course, affects, retirement, too. Let's go back to emails. Michelle says, I started early and I've been very disciplined in saving. Now my husband and I have close to $2.5 million. Good for you, Michelle. We have no debt other than our house, which will be paid off by the time we retire. We're in our early 60s and we invest in a moderate risk portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Is now the time to seek a safer, less risk tolerant portfolio? So this mix of funds, Nick Abrams, how much should be in stock, how much should be in bonds, how much should be in cash at various ages of your life?
So what I would advise in this situation is to sit down with a professional and find out what your asset allocation should be. And here's why I say that. You know, there's a rule of thumb, an unwritten rule of thumb, that the older you are, the more conservative you should be. And that's not necessarily true. My oldest client is 99, and he still likes to be aggressive. He swears he's going to live to 120. I have some clients that are in their 20s and 30s that are very conservative because they saw what their parents went through with the Great Recession. So you want to find out personally between you and your husband what your situation is and what type of risk you're willing to take, number one. And once you find out what your risk tolerance is, then you can work to design a portfolio that matches that risk tolerance. And more importantly, you want to update that. Because right now the market is in a high place. We're setting records. So people are very gung-ho about risk. I want to take more risk because I want more returns because my friend told me they're getting 20%. So I want to get 25%. But then on the flip side, when we go through those corrections, that mood changes. People, I don't want the risk. I can't take the risk. I don't want to see my account going down. So really having that honest conversation and sitting in and looking at where you should be will help guide. And then the other factor, and we haven't talked about this much, with that portfolio in your IRA, how are you going to handle taxes? Because that becomes a tax issue with the type of money that's in an IRA, unless it's in a Roth IRA, which I suspect it's not. All of that money now becomes taxable when you withdraw that. And there was an article in U.S. News written by a friend of mine, Rodney Brooks, that talked about how your $1 million in your IRA is really worth $600,000 when you factor in taxes. So sitting down with a professional, taking a look at all of those factors would be very helpful, I think.
Yeah, and Stuart Ritter, that magic number when people are thinking about retirement and how long they're going to live. Of course, no one can predict how long they're going to live with any accuracy. But in 2018, a group called Bankrate did a survey that said 13% of Americans are actually saving less for retirement than last year. Experts typically recommend trying to accumulate at least $1 million to retire. $1 million is a lot of money for a lot of people. One in three Americans have less than $5,000 saved for retirement. How do you advise folks what that number should be, what you're going to quote-unquote need when you retire?
Let me throw out a couple of numbers for people in different life stages. So if you're still saving for retirement, we tell people to plan on saving 15% of your salary. So if you take nothing else away from today's show, if you remember just one number, remember 15%. That's how much of your household, your gross household income, should be putting away for retirement. And if you work for an employer who, as Nick pointed out, is kicking in some money, you get to subtract that amount from the 15%. So 15% is what you need to save. save. When you're getting to the point where you're thinking about retirement, the other number to remember is 4%. It just helps people turn this big, giant pot of money, which is probably bigger than any amount of money people have ever had in their lives, into what you can think about it might generate for the first year in retirement. Because you're going to have a 30-year retirement. You're planning for that. But if you take what you've saved and multiply it by 4%, that gives you a sense of what income you can take that first year from the amount of money you've saved. So then you can look at that dollar amount and say, well, if I have that amount of money, plus my Social Security, plus anything, maybe you're working part-time, maybe you do have an old DB plan, is that going to have the kind of lifestyle I want in retirement? And if not, then maybe I wait a little longer. Maybe I save a little more. So the 15% is how much to save. The 4% lets you just mentally, that first year for 65, translate that big pot of money into a dollar figure, and that can help you make the decision.
Let's go back to the phones. I believe it's Donald in Ellicott City. Donald, welcome to Midday. How you doing? Oh, Donald is gone, but Donald, his question evidently was, I just got a $100,000 settlement related to my 9/11 injuries, and I don't know whether or how to invest the money. Any suggestions? Where would you start with a big chunk of money like that?
So with that, you want to look at what's the purpose of the investment. Is it just for money to have to pay other bills? Is it just to let it sit there and grow and accumulate? As we said earlier, and Stuart alluded to earlier, if you're looking at something short term, then you want to keep it in some type of bank instrument, savings, money market, CD. If you're looking to have this money grow for long term, then you can start looking at building a portfolio with it. So it really depends on what your time frame is for using or utilizing those funds.
We have an email from Ann. We haven't had a chance to talk much about taxes. We only have a couple minutes left, but Ann in Ellicott City says, do you have any ideas how to minimize the taxes paid on required minimum withdrawal from IRA accounts? Of course, that question could be broadened to just, you know, do you have any suggestions as to how to minimize taxes in general? We evidently got a tax cut in 2017. This 2018 tax year is the first year that people are either feeling it or not. People in Maryland are feeling it a lot less than people in some other states. But Stuart Ritter, in terms of taxes, how does that calculate into everything?
Yeah, Ann is talking about something very specific, required minimum distributions for saving for retirement in what we now call traditional accounts, traditional IRAs or traditional 401ks. You didn't pay taxes on the money when it went in, but you pay taxes on the money when it comes out. And the government has said when you reach age 70 and a half, we're going to require you to take the money out so we can tax it, a required minimum amount that you distribute. So you're required to take that money out. There's no way to avoid it except if you make a direct charitable contribution to a charity, that amount can count towards your RMD and you don't have to pay taxes.
RMD is
required minimum distribution.
Distribution again.
For people who are over age 70 and a half and they have a traditional IRA or a traditional 401k, they're required to take the money out.
Just got a few seconds left, but Nick Abrams, with the new tax law, the standard deduction is now much higher, so people are deducting. Many fewer people are doing itemized deduction, yes, for their charitable contributions or their property taxes or things like that. Are you finding a lot of your clients significantly affected by these new changes?
Yes, we've seen it across the board, and we've seen it on both ends of the spectrums. Those clients who traditionally itemized, because of the way the new law was written, they're not allowed to itemize as much, or some of the deductions they used to be able to itemize, they can't. So they are feeling the tax burden. Some clients who were more traditional took the standard deduction are doing better because they've got an increase in that standard deduction. So what I tell people, and I recommend, you've got to figure out who's on your team. You've got to have a good financial planner, a good tax planner, a good estate planning attorney, a good insurance professional, and you have to utilize your team. No successful person does it all by themselves. Put together a good team and bring them to the table and say, this is the situation. how do we solve the problem?
Well, you guys are a terrific team that we've put together, and I appreciate very much both of you coming by, and we'll do it again sometime.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
All right. Nick Abrams is a certified financial planner and the founder and CEO of AJW Financial Partners based here in Baltimore. Stuart Ritter is senior financial planner in the individual investors segment at T. Rowe Price. Coming up tomorrow on our program, my guest is Nathaniel Rich. He's the author of Losing Earth, A Recent History. It's a book about missed opportunities 3 decades ago and the global response to climate change. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have a review of Pantheon at the Happenstance Theater here in Baltimore. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. That's it for us today. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming up right after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.